Good morning. This is Barry Wirth from ScreenGeeks.com, and we're talking with Gary Lockwood. Thank you, sir, for being here with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Barry.
My first question, how did you get started in this business as an actor?
Oh, God, that's a long one. Well, let's see now. I was going to UCLA. I beat some fraternity guy up. I got kicked out of school. I went to Mexico. I came back. One of the football coaches, I was also an English major and a football player. One of the football coaches was cashing a check at the gas station in Westwood where I went to UCLA. And I looked at that check and I said, Sam, what was that for? And he said, well, I was working on this movie and da-da-da. He said, oh, you know, aren't you a cowboy? Didn't you? I was in the rodeo as a kid a little bit with Monty Montana and stuff like that. I traveled around America some when I was younger. And anyway, so then the story is, here's what I did. I called the athletic department at UCLA and I said, I'm not coming back to play if I can't get one of those cards in the movie business. Because I knew that once I rode a few horses, you know, that, you know, I was good at it, better than most people. And so I knew that I'd get a lot of work. Well, I really got a lot of work. So one day I go see about doubling an actor in a movie called The Tall Story with Jane Fonda.
I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's about a Russian basketball team traveling through America. And I went to, on the interview, and Carol Adams, who had been a basketball player at UCLA, you know, all of us athletes knew each other. And so Carol, the director kept looking at me like that, and I thought, well, you know, maybe he's a little weird, you know, maybe he's weird. And I thought to myself, finally he turns to Carol and he said, that guy right there, what's that guy's name? Carol says, well, he's Polish and German. His name is Jurassic. And we call him the Kraut. And he said, has he ever done any acting? And I was a bit of a hustler in school. You know, I was a poker player and I owned a lot of football players' tickets. You know, I was one of those scalper types.
Nice.
And I lived in Malibu on the beach and drove a Porsche. So you can understand what I mean. I was a different kind of guy at school. Today it's common, but not my day. And anyway, here's the part where I become an actor. The director said, we have a part for a Russian basketball player in here who can actually play basketball. Can he play? And Carol said, yeah, he can play. I had been a really big basketball star in high school. And so he said, oh, yeah, he's a good player. He plays half court at night in the gym, you know, and all that, or he did. And so I got the job, and it was 14 weeks of work without falling off a horse or getting beat up.
Nice.
And it was like, this is okay. And about 8 months later, I'm on Broadway with Jane Fonda.
Wow. Fantastic.
And then all kinds of things happen, so.
Everyone always jumps to 2001. I want to go to Splendor in the Grass. That's one of the great American movies. What was your, just some thoughts of what was it like being in that film?
Well, I didn't have a big part. I was in it a lot, many hours, you know. What was it like, Kazan?
Yeah, what's Kazan like? Yeah, absolutely.
Kazan was okay. He was, you know, he wasn't Kubrick. He was a little bit more hands-on with the actor types, but didn't care as much about his shots. And I was an artist type as a kid, you know, and Kazan movies were not my... I mean, I didn't flip out over them. I liked them.
Yeah.
But it sure was a calling card, you know, for an actor to be... Because he put me under contract. And... But that wasn't uncommon if they had a young guy that looked like he could do something. And Warren Beatty was under contract, and myself and one other girl. And we worked all over upstate New York, out on Long Island. William Inge wrote it, and later, well, that's another story for maybe later on. But I ended up doing Bus Stop, the television version that Inge wrote. So, but anyway, it was fine in Splendor. I enjoyed myself. A lot of beautiful girls on location. My God. I like that one.
Well, what's it like being in a movie with Elvis Presley?
Elvis was a great guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, these people write books about them and everything. They try to get you to say bad things about them, but I liked them. I mean, I'll tell you how we became friendly. I got the job. I was just another actor on the job. I had a fun part. He's supposed to kill me later on with a, I think. I don't remember the story that much, but it was to be his, like, major dramatic. The film originally wasn't designed for music and everything. That was all put in later after they screened it and didn't get good reports. So they went back and put in some songs. But one day, there was this good-looking girl in there, and I was chatting her up on my lunch hour. And Elvis is, you know, the Memphis Mafia guys, they call them, all the Allen and Sonny and all those guys, Chief. They love football. They're from the South, you know. And they're throwing a football around, and it bounces at my feet. And nothing, you know, I grew up throwing them every day, you know. And, in fact, your Denver star here, Elway, my father once said, you come out and we're going to go to the high school game. There's a guy here who's better than you were. And I went and he was better than him. But anyway, I had been a big star as a kid in football, see. So the ball came to me, and I just picked it up and threw him a pass, you know, like kind of razor sharp, and about 20 yards. Not real far, but like, and their eyes all lit up because they had a touch football team. And so they went back in inside and told Elvis. And when I went back to him, next time I did a scene with him, he said, hey, Gary, I understand you can throw the football. And I said, I can. So I was his quarterback in some flag football games around town. And
nice.
Yeah, well, everybody always wanted to hurt him, but he was a good guy. He was a hell of a guy. I liked him.
What do you tell people who say they're just about to watch 2001 A Space Odyssey for the first time? Is there any way to prepare them? Is there anything you tell them?
Well, it's a little difficult today to talk to a young person who's about to go see the movie because, you know, that's another time period. And that movie was, I hate to say it, but flawlessly made. I mean, that's not a fly-by-night piece of work. I mean, that's precision timing, you know. I mean, and there's no quick cutting and pacing and, you know. I mean, you get to the second half of the picture when you're going to the Stargate and all that. It's a little different there, but for the most part, it's eloquent and artful, and we had a lot of things that never appeared in the film that were incredible in the rushes. I mean, visually. But Stanley left some of them out only because he wanted the people to kind of buy into the humdrum life of the astronaut, you know, and the whole thing, so that he could zap them more at the end. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was trying to constantly create a sense of reality. But there were some shots in there that were so unbelievable. I mean, in terms of abstract and shall we say, Picasso-like, you know what I'm saying? But Kubrick was a great guy to work for. And you hear all these stories about that he wasn't, or he was this, or he's... It's very precise, but no finer gentleman I ever knew, and nobody ever smarter.
How do you feel when people say, I know what this film means? Do you feel the need to correct them, or do you want them to walk away with whatever interpretation they have?
Well, I'm not a religious fella, and I don't believe in very much. I just kind of think that... as human beings, we're pretty frustrated here, so we come up with all kinds of stuff. And because we can't explain the incredible universe we live in, or the, you know, we just can't explain it. We learn a little more each year, but we don't know anything. Come on. Somebody tries to tell me we know something, I just look at it. I can't even say anything to them. And, you know, the movie is basically a sci-fi story. It's, you know, it's not really, it didn't ever really happen. But the idea is that it got people thinking and it got them tripped out. And it changed a lot of lives for people who were a little bit above the curve in the IQ. They were all a little bit... The people who liked it was a bit of a litmus test. And so that particular group of people, when I've done... You know, I've traveled around the world with this film. You know, Australia, Japan, Germany, you know. And the common denominator is, I saw that movie and it changed my life. Now, that's a pretty big statement. Tom Hanks personally said to me one day, he said, I saw that movie and I decided to be an actor. Or I saw that movie and I dropped out of med school. You see?
Yeah.
And I went into computers, or I went over to the engineering department, or, you know, that the picture played hell with some people who were open to the, you know, who allowed themselves to say, what is going on here? So, you know, for somebody to come up and tell you they know exactly what this was or this was or this was, that's ridiculous. I mean, a lot of it we made up as we went along. I'll tell you something you might enjoy. I didn't even know it was going to happen. Are we okay time-wise here?
Yep, we're good.
Okay. One day, I always go along very well with Kubrick, but one day, after about 4 or 5 weeks of trying to increase the paranoia, Hal's paranoia.
Yeah.
And Arthur and Stanley started collaborating on little bits of stuff that we would say or that we would do, which was to lead to Hal's, you know, feeling aggressed upon. And it was kind of annoying me. You know, I don't get into the writing of things. I stay in my place as an actor most of the time. But here I am in this great movie, and I'm pretty positive that was going to be a great movie. I mean, I know it sounds pretty arrogant, but I mean, Arthur Clarke, Stanley Kubrick in sci-fi, and I had read a good part of the script. You know, it wasn't a lot of script. I mean, a lot of it was made up. But the point that I'm, not all the mechanics of the shots, but the words and certain activity were made up. And this one day, I just kind of had it. And so I was doing this scene with Keir, and I was pretty annoyed. And Stanley looked over, and he was a diminutive guy, and he had a beard, and he's scratching his fingers like that. And you guys are techie types, so you know what I'm saying. And he's like, and I was the jock of the movie, but I was a reader. You know, Stanley knew I was pretty bright, but. And he looks over and he goes, Lockwood, something seems to be upsetting you. Is that right? He was really cool, you know. And I thought, okay, well, they think I'm being a redneck now, right? And I was a football player, but I was a quarterback. I called all the shots, and I just went right into that mode. And I said, well, you know, Stanley, this scene, it's like when I was a kid, there was this great-looking girl, and she was a milkman's daughter, and she'd come down the aisle, and she'd hand out the test papers. And I would look at her sometimes, and I'd look at her beautiful fanny, and I'd say, hey, Peggy, how about a piece? Yuck, yuck, yuck. Well, that's what this scene makes me feel like. And pretty funny, isn't it? Because I'm that type of guy. You know, I'm now push, piss on it, I'm going to do it. Well, I didn't mean that. I'm the kind of guy that's going to do it that way, you know.
Yeah.
We retread that. And he had an assistant director named Derek Cracknell. What a great name for an AD. Because an AD is a guy that runs a job, you know. And he turns and goes, Daryl, and it's about 11:30 in the morning, and we're getting like very few shots every week. Our rushes are, you know, over in 20 minutes for the week. And he's Derek, and Cracknell was like this, yes, Gov. And he said, that's a wrap for today. Well, huge movie like that, we're wrapping at 11:30. I go up to my room, and it was night next to Kubrick. We had big dressing rooms, and so I'm exercising in there to stay fit, you know. And Cracknell knocks on my door, and anyway, the end of the story is that the Gov wants to see you. So I walk into, I knock on Stanley's door, says, come on in, Lockwood. So I walk in, and he looks at me and goes, so Lockwood, you're Polish, right? I said, well, I'm Polish and German. And he said, well, yeah, but I mean, do you drink Stolichnaya? And I said, yeah. And he, Stanley, in his dressing room, had everything. Wall of music, alcohol, you know, he just had everything. He was one of those kind of guys. He had every gadget. You know, he was a techie guy all the way. And he said, He pours me. He said, "How do you like your vodka?" I said, "In a snifter glass." He pulls down a pulls me a little vodka. And I said, "Hey, Stanley, why beat around the bush? Are you going to fire me?" Because he fired people, you know,
yeah,
a lot of times. And I said, "You're going to fire me? Okay." But I said, "You know, that's the way it is." He looked at me and he said, "No, Lockwood," he said, "I'm not going to fire you." He said, "Look, you've been a really good, you know, participant with us. I mean, you've been cool. But I'll tell you something. Whenever an actor who is, you know, doing a good job and being a decent person has a problem, I have learned to pay attention to it. Because I know that you guys think about your part differently than a director does. You know, we're thinking about all," he said. "And usually they like to protect their character or something. And so you're getting pretty upset with what where we're going." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, here's what I'd like to do. I'm going to have my driver take you back," because I lived in London and Bournemouth was out in the country. I'm making this too long, am I? Anyway.
Okay. No, finish the story.
He said, "Eddie, my driver will take you in." He said, "He'll stop in Golders Green, get you a lot of nice deli food and whatever." And he said, "And the next time I hear from you, you come up with an answer what to do." So I guess my job's on the line, you know, or whatever. I don't know. So I go back, and on the way in, I was friendly with his driver, Eddie. And Eddie and I talked, and he said, "Yes, yeah, Stanley's a character." And I said, "I know he is." He said, "So I've never taken anybody back to the city at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever." And I got home, and, you know, we all have our way of solving problems, but mine is to list all the problems. So I go get a tablet of paper, and I start writing down what am I really angry about, or what is really going off, or what is the real problem, the essence of it. And what we were trying to do is to educate the audience with time lag differential and all the various facets of travel, because nobody knows anything. You know, the average person sits down, they don't know orbital velocity is, you know, 17.5 or, you know, they don't know these things.
Yeah.
And so we were trying to educate them slowly with this sort of expositional dialogue between Kira, myself, or whatever. And I just sat there, and about 10 o'clock that night, I go, bam, I got it. You know, the old epiphany. Or
yeah.
I asked Bill Lear, the Learjet guy, once in Acapulco. I asked him one day, I said, "What happens when, you know, you get the epiphany?" And he was so brilliant. He goes, "Oh, there's nothing to that. That's just when your subconscious mind has fed in the missing link. You see, you've got this problem and you're solving it, and then the missing link comes in there, and 2 hours later you go, oh, I know how to fix that problem.
Yeah.
And I went bam like this, and I was all excited. So I thought, oh, I can't call Kruber, it's 10 o'clock at night. Well, I call him anyway, and he's still up, and he says, what is your idea? I said, "Well, here's what we do. Kier tells me he's having trouble with D transmitter and C pod. We go down there, we climb inside the pod, we get in there, we start talking about everything, you know, and then basically I'm saying, you know, and he does this, and then he reads our lips, and then we do all this." And Kubrick goes, like, on the other side of the phone, he goes, "Whoa." I said, "Yeah, we can have a scene between two actors in a conversational scene, and we can get all the information out in a conversation, like in movies, they have somebody go to a shrink, and they sit there and tell the whole story,
right,
and set up everything." You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was just an actor's trick, you know. And I remember Kubrick said, "I'm going to wake Eddie up." And Eddie came and picked me up at 11:30 in London. I went back to Stanley's, and with these little York 400 report L reel-to-reel tape recorders, you got to remember, it's the 60s.
Yeah.
None of this, you know. And there was no digital revolution. Anyway, the end of the story is we worked until about 11 o'clock the next day. His wife kept feeding him sandwiches. And,
wow.
And we basically improvised that entire scene, that whole 8.5-minute scene. And then he cleaned it up some. And then the next, if you ever see the movie again, I want you to watch for this, because this is the end of my little thing here. We get in the pod, and I think Kier who played Dave Bowman, says, "Rotate the pod, Hal." Pod rotates. And then he reaches over and he pulls the circuitry. And then he comes back. And I don't remember if I say something, but I think both of us say, "Rotate the pod, Hal." Yeah. "Hal, rotate the pod." And then I remember in our original improvisation, it was like this. Kier says, he looks at me, and I'm supposed to be like the, like the guy that keeps everything running, see? Mm-hmm. And he looks at me and he says, "What do you think?" And I had, here's the original line that we later changed. "Well, you know, David, frankly, I don't give a damn." And I look over at him and I say, you know, he's gone off and go into my normal dialogue.
Yeah.
And so then we start talking about, well, I have to cut his higher brain functions and all that.
Yeah.
"Well, if you don't like 2001 and you don't like the scene where Kier disconnects Hal, there's something wrong with you. I mean, you know, either you just don't like sci-fi or that's one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen."
It's a magnificent scene.
Unbelievable. And these beautiful, clear plastic things coming up. And Kier is like, you know, breathing and trying to disconnect this thing. And what are you doing? And all that. I'm a Hal, what, 9,000, I was born in Champaign, Illinois in 1997. And he starts, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
So, you know, I say to the MTV generation, it's all great, but there's not much content to it. And so if you're a person who has a bit of a brain on you and you want to watch something that has some content, then try to zen out, relax yourself, take a breath, let out half of it, turn on the movie, get a good chair, and don't worry about the score of the game or whatever, and watch the movie.
Yeah.
Because you can, with all this technology now, you can stop the disc anytime you want, your Blu-ray, and look at the shots. I mean, there's so many great shots in that movie that, you know, it's like a perfume with a garden hose. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Good tip. We're out of time. Good, you just cut me off.